Yesterday we left off our view of England's progress with the first Jewish community set up in London in nearly 450 years. We will eventually see great things from them. However, the first Jewish traders are looked upon somewhat askance at the outset. However, time and chance come to all men. When I last spoke, we saw the final emergence of a new Tarsus as a real power on this earth. It came as a combination of strength and might, but not man's. As the saying goes, man plots and proposes, God defeats and disposes. So it was with the Spanish Armada, so it would occur again during the reign of Louis XIV, Napoleon Bonaparte, and Adolf Hitler. In this lecture, England will go through a period of time that will test its mettle. Where progress was made on one front, they often gave it up on another. Because of the Navigation Act, English warships would waylay Dutch merchantmen to see if English goods were in their holds, and then they would roughly treat their captain and crew. You know, the United States found out about this too before the War of 1812, when English ships waylaid some of ours for the same reason. Here was the spark to set off a powder keg that was to be the Dutch and English wars. And altogether, three of these wars, or many naval wars, were fought. Oh, how different it could have been had they took a page from the Dutch experience and allowed their Jewish witness to show them a better way. In the North Sea, bloody battles were fought with hundreds of warships having at one another on both sides. Whatever advantage England had due to their naval board and ship-of-the-line tactics was eventually lost due to a superior Dutch economy and Dutch captains such as Tromp, De Witt, and De Ruyter. At the four-day battle, and later at the Battle of the Medway on the Thames, much of Charles II's great fleet was damaged, burned, or ended up on the rocks. What England required were policies that would enhance her friends, not put them in a state of conflict, if the papist threat would be kept at bay. Remember, if they're not against us, they're for us. Those were the words of Christ Jesus. By the way, Christadelphians could take a note from that. Similarly, the turn the world upside down policies of the Stuarts kings brought a time similar to the book of Judges. To England, when Charles came to be king, many people welcomed it with a collective sigh of relief. No longer was the intensely religious fever forced upon them as it had been with the Puritans. Suddenly, they drifted back again into being what one writer calls Hellenistic. After nearly 50 years of being intense, England breathed a long sigh of collective relief and were determined to be merry, to be good-humored, to be anything but serious. When I talk about serious, I mean serious about their lives, about their outlook, about their religious convictions. As Barbara Tuchman expressed it in her book, The Bible and the Sword, in reaction to awful devout Puritanism, the Hellenic mood returned. It left men clear-headed, but uncomfortable with the craving for some omnipotent authority unsatisfied. Deism tried to supply a substitute for the Bible as revelation. The deists offered a God whom all men of reason could believe in, a God whose existence was proved by all the wonders of nature and who needed no miracles, prophecies, or other supernatural revelations to show himself to mankind. In its original religion, the age was high church. Polite, and satisfied to serve no other purpose than to offer its preferments as a refuge to the nobility's younger sons and deserving relations. Remember, in that day, if you were the eldest son, you were the one who gained everything, the estate, all your father had. So the younger sons of these noble families ended up oftentimes working in the church. Not necessarily a good idea. As for a person's religion, what chance had the Bible in a church personified by Jane Austen's insipid curate, Mr. Collins? Once again, the ale poured and sin abounded. Indeed, it was during this time that many forgot their religion altogether. The king greatly helped that spirit along by passing the Act of Uniformity, compelling Puritans to accept the doctrines of the Church of England. Still, it was his bad example, more than anything else, that brought derision to England's so-called godly worship. Imagine, brothers and sisters, one who was looked upon as the head of the Church of England having 17 illegitimate children. This was a time of letting loose, of greed, of stupidity. This was a time when trade wars abounded with natural friends. In the end, England's young men would sell their lives dearly and for naught. In the ensuing wars, disaster followed on disaster. The first war, England fared well, but as the second and third continued, England began to feel the damaging effects of their arrogance and their conceit. First, the great ship, the Royal Sovereign, a 56-gun, beautifully designed and built square rigger, burned to its waterline at the River Medway. Why? Because a cook forgot to extinguish a candle. In 1666, Charles' peaceful and entertaining capital, with its many theaters and mosques, received a real damaging blow. In history, it's called the Great Fire of London. It started in a crowded row housing and then moved out to the main city area. It was fueled for three consecutive days by a steady and strong easterly breeze. Thousands lost their homes and many their lives by the rapid spread of it. London lost 461 acres of buildings, which included 87 parish churches, 52 guild halls and trading companies, and even the greatest medieval church of its time, St. Paul's Cathedral. Add to that list 15,000 dwellings, and you can get a bird's eye view of just how terrible that time was. And yet, brothers and sisters, as bad as that fire was, it was nothing compared with the return of the dreaded Black Plague the year before. Think of it. Husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, thousands of people perished during that time. While the dead bodies littered the street waiting to be picked up, families continued to suffer the onslaught of this terrible, terrible disaster. Though quarantine helped, the disease seemed to find ways to break out. And after all this occurred, a major crop failure ensued. England was not only suffering from fire and disease and crop failures, it was suffering from wars as well. When Charles II's negotiation for an end to the Second Dutch War dragged into the year 1667, England experienced its biggest humiliation. In the year, want of money prevented the English battle fleet from taking to the sea. So under the cover of darkness, Admiral De Witt, the Dutch admiral, sailed up the Medway River, broke through the boom which guarded Chatham Harbor, and burnt four ships of the line to their watermark. Afterwards, they towed away the battleship HMS Royal Charles. This was not lost on the English people. the continued bad news of Dutch success at English expense was seen as God's indignation on an evil nation. In the general resentment and alarm that followed, even the Cavaliers, natural enemies to the Roundhead Puritans, now aging, remarked that they had never seen such disasters befall England during the rulership of the Lord Protector, Oliver Cromwell. Brothers and sisters, when Winston Churchill wrote in his book, and this book was called A History of the English-Speaking People, The New World, he expressed it this way. Among the Puritans, the plague, the fire, and the disasters at sea were regarded as direct visitation by which the Almighty chastised the immorality of the age and especially of the court. Nevertheless, like the time of the judges, not only does God know how to punish his people, he also knows how to save them. When Charles II died, his brother James II, formerly the Duke of York, took the throne and attempted to bring Catholicism by his own actions and a series of law back into being in England. It was during this time that a miracle occurred of the first order that I would be most remiss if I did not bring to your attention. However, before I can go there, we have to understand that the Catholic power in Europe had shifted from Spain to France. Under Louis XIV, a civil war in France was ended and the Protestants defeated. The revocation of the Edict of Nantes meant that Protestantism was dead in France. Catholicism was restored, and with such a large population, Louis XIV was able to use all that tax revenue to build both France's army and their navy into Europe's foremost power. Soon they, not the British, had the largest and most powerful navy in the world, and unlike Britain, the largest, best-trained army in the world. It was an awesome force, and one heretofore not reckoned with. Equally, because of their larger population, the king had the tax money to move his residence out of Paris and build the famous Palace of Versailles. To this day, it is considered one of the most beautiful palace complexes in the world. It was complete with gardens, fountains, and the famous Hall of Mirrors. Unlike the dark streets of Paris, everything here was designed to use light. From that day on, Louis XIV moved in. He became known as the Sun King. Notwithstanding, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It is sometimes a matter of one's perspective. Unquestionably, man can give titles and promote individuals. He can build magnificent structures and call his large population into a concentrated military force of world-sized proportion. However, in the eyes of God, this ostentatious display was nothing more than that, ostentatious. Nevertheless, a united Catholic France and a weak Spain warned of dark storm clouds ahead for Protestant Europe, most especially for England, Holland, and the German states. Now, William of Orange, leader of Holland, was one of the first to realize the danger. You see, just before Charles II died, he made a most interesting revelation about himself and about his family. He stated categorically that he was a closet Catholic. Moreover, it was later revealed that two of the English wars with the Dutch had been in part financed by Louis XIV to the tune of £200,000. Louis wanted more than anything to bring back worldwide Catholicism. He was at best when playing friends against one another, and then once the adversaries were weak, attacked them directly. The biggest and the most damning revelation was that bringing England back to Catholicism would have earned Charles II an additional $200,000. Unfortunately for Charles, he would die before that dream became a reality. However, with his brother James II, ascension to the throne, the specter of another Bloody Mary's reign became as real a possibility as ever before. Unlike his brother, James II raised suspicion from the outset of his reign. He did not call Parliament into session, nor did he make his intentions to bring back Catholicism a secret. To remind everyone who was the boss, he parked 40,000 Catholic Irishmen on London's Green in order that the public might see them training there daily. Moreover, he placed Catholics in high places in both the government and military, and especially in the Navy. These events were alarming to the people of England. The people themselves would have been very happy if they had just leave James alone and just wait till after James died and his daughter, Mary, who was now the wife of William III of Holland, would come to her reign because she was Protestant. But suddenly, the new wife that James had taken was pregnant and she had a child and it was a young boy. And suddenly, they could see a whole reign or a whole length of reigns of English kings being Catholic, and it caused great consternation in the state. Suddenly, the people, as I said, could see a whole line of Catholic kings and queens before them. And so from every pub and alehouse, from every tavern and eatery, the sounds of whispering people, fearful of the new legislation James was promoting called the Act of Indulgence, began first by talking, but soon by plotting. The people of England reasoned that if the Edict of Nantes could be thrown out the window by Louis XIV of France and thereby made it a crime to be Protestant, why not a similar situation in England? Why not indeed? It was clear that the king did not understand the deep-seated hatred entrenched in their minds left by Mary Tudor. Or did he care? For the people, the present legislation smelled of Louis XIV. Now, across the seas, William of Orange and his wife Mary, daughter of James II, knew that their country, Holland, could not sustain another war, especially not fighting the combination of both France and England. The recent past wars had almost broken Holland financially. William III, or William of Orange, convinced the States General of Holland that they were in great peril. Obtaining their permission, and that wasn't easy to get, he gathered Dutch naval and merchant ships from across Holland from June to October of 1688. William knew he had to move quickly. Already, on the flimsiest of pretenses, Dutch ships were being taken as prizes in French ports. By the autumn of 1688, William of Orange had garnered a fleet of nearly 411 smaller ships to be escorted by 50 larger naval vessels. His plan was to put Protestant forces from all over Europe inside his merchant ships. These would be Germans, French Huguenots, two Scottish regiments, Danish Swiss, and a large contingent of Dutch forces. From Holland, they would be conveyed to an undisclosed English shore. Time was of the essence. With so many men and materials being formed up in Dutch harbors, he could not hope to keep his plans secret forever. Once at sea, he would make his intentions known to his generals. But while in Holland, everything had to remain a secret. William knew that his chances of success were most appalling. He was also aware that if failure occurred, there would not be enough forces left in Holland to fight the coming French onslaught. Truly, he was rolling the dice. Nevertheless, he waited until he heard that France had temporarily sent their large army eastward to battle the League of Augsburg, or the German states. Back in England, Messages from France had given James II good reason for suspicion. Even Louis XIV sent him message saying, "Beware, something's up." Still, James II was sustained in his thinking that his son-in-law and daughter would not turn against him. Moreover, James II, who formerly had been one of Britain's great admirals, knew that the traditional autumn winds in the North Sea were just way too strong and contrary to count on for any military action of consequence. That was the great risk that William III of Orange ate with, slept with, and prepared with every single hour of the day. Would the English fleet take to the sea? Would they act on the Catholic king's orders? What would the winds be like when he finally set sail? All of these things raced through his mind. On October 29th, the Dutch flotilla departed. William walked on his flagship, the Brill, with his banners flapping in the freshening breeze. It displayed the Orange family motto, "I will maintain." And then he added below it, in great big letters, "the liberties of England and the Protestant religion." He also let his officers know that they were to prepare to land on the Yorkshire coast and then march southward to London. Could you put the map on? Bring it down, Matthew. Down. Where the map shows.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Okay, thank you. We're talking about here is where William is, and he wants just to come over to here. Not that far, really. And yet, he's going to run into some of the worst winds of a lifetime. And these winds are coming right out from the northwest. And you can imagine, if you're a sailing ship and you're trying to sail towards the west and the winds are coming out of the west, what difficulty would be. And so on the first day, which I think was the 29th of October, he ran into very heavy, strong winds and storms. And it forced him all the way down on the coast here. The next day, he was able to tack back and enter into Amsterdam's harbor. 24 hours had gone by, and he hadn't made one bit of progress. He would wait two more days, and then he tried again. But once again, the winds were extremely strong. Couldn't do it. And so he was forced into the most difficult situation of a lifetime. And that was, should I proceed to go southward from here, down through the Straits of Dover, and then westward and land somewhere over here? This was better territory. It certainly was friendly territory. But to get there, he would have to go by the Downs. And that's where the English naval fleet was. And over here, when he got down to the Straits of Dover, his actions would be seen by the French. So he had all of these things in his mind. Could he make it? What could he do? And the worst part of it was that if the English came out to fight him, there was no way that he could protect his merchant ships with all those men in it and hold off the English at the same time. So disaster was facing him in all directions. Nevertheless, he had to leave it to the hands of God. He just put it to prayer as well as his men, and they decided to throw caution to the wind and head southward. And so they began their trek down this way right here. Unfortunately, Lord Dartmouth, who was the English admiral, saw his flagship and saw the fleet. And he too, immediately, being warned by the king, got his fleet up and were ready and prepared to do battle. Unfortunately, they had to go out around a spit of land called the Kentish Knock. It wasn't just a straight outlet into the sea, to the North Sea. And the winds were so contrary that he couldn't do it. He couldn't get his ships around that isthmus of land. And so he was stuck there as he watched the Dutch fleet go quickly by him. And that night they crossed through the Straits of Dover and the next day they began to head westward to the southern ports of England. Now, he was 2 hours behind him, at least, but he was right on his trail. And eventually, over the next day or two, they finally decided to make a port right here, a place called Torbay, just a little bit north of Portsmouth Harbor, or Plymouth Harbor. In any event, they did. But just as finally they got there and they began to unload the men and the supplies, wouldn't you know it, right on the horizon they could see the English sails. And they were coming with ports open and guns run out. Everything looked bad. They were caught betwixt and between, trying to get men off their ships, and with supplies all over their docks, here were coming the English. And that's when it happened. Once again, an extremely heavy gale came up. But this time, it came again from this direction. And this time, it forced the English back. No matter what they tried to do by tacking, they weren't able to go against this heavy gale. And suddenly, they were forced to go right back up through the Straits of Dover and stay at the Downs. And by that, the Dutch were able to unload all their supplies, their men. And several days later, they would begin their long march right along here to London. And amazingly, everything from then on fell apart. Once the word that the Dutch were there, once the word got out that a big Dutch army was there, the English rallied to them. Everywhere, people brought food and supplies to help them along their way. Cheers of crowds greeted them. And all of this got back to James II, and James lost heart. He changed his clothes into something that looked more like a normal commoner. He took the seal of England, he ran away, threw it in the Thames, and crossed England into France. And the next day, the day after he left, Dartmouth surrendered the English navy to the Dutch. Think about that. Two great navies were not destroyed in any of that battle. They were completely intact and now in the hands of a Protestant king and queen, William and Mary of Orange. And it didn't miss them either that this was the 100th anniversary since the time that the English had fought the Spanish Armada. In fact, William of Orange looked over to his second in command and says, "What do you think now of predestination?" Any of it, England became solid with Holland as allies. And that meant that suddenly from the north and from the northeast, there was Protestants on both sides of Louis XIV. And that's what made it difficult now for him to fight any new wars. Matthew, put up Job. I ask you again, was it happenstance that the wind changed twice to oppose the English ships of the line, while in both cases advancing the Dutch? What occurred happened for a reason. Nothing happens of that significance without God being involved. I want you to take a look at the words of Job 37, verses 10 through 13. He says, "And from breath of the Mighty One he will send frost, and he guides the water in whatsoever way he pleases. And if a cloud obscures what is precious to him, his light will disperse the cloud. And he will carry round the encircling clouds by his governance to perform their works, whatsoever he shall command them. This has been appointed by him on the earth, whether for correction or for his land, or if he shall find him an object of mercy." Clearly, William of Orange received God's mercy on this 21st day of November, 1688. Because of the action of the wind, neither fleets were damaged or destroyed, which would later aid the Protestant cause greatly. In the coming wars, Louis XIV would now face two enemies at sea. Psalms 107, verses 23 through 30 states, these are the words of David, "They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep. For he commandeth and raiseth the stormy wind, which lifteth up the gales thereof. They mount up to heaven, they go down again to the depths. Their soul is melted because of trouble. They reel to and fro and stagger like a drunken man, and are at their wit's end. Then they cry unto the Lord in their trouble, and he bringeth them out of their distresses. He maketh the storm a calm, so that the waves thereof are still. Then are they glad because they be quiet, so he bringeth them unto their desired haven. Oh, that the man would praise the Lord for his goodness and for his wonderful works to the children of men." In the coming days, England would fight numerous wars of succession. It started after William and Mary and became England's monarchs. In 1690, the put down of the Irish rebellion at the Battle of the Boyne occurred, and in 1691, the commencement of the Continental Wars with France, which lasted until 1697. During this difficult time, the Dutch influence set up what today is known as the National Debt and the Bank of England. These two foundations took the problem of financing wars out of the hands of kings and placed them squarely into the hands of Parliament, the Exchequer. It allowed the country to run up deficits in times of conflict and pay their bills over time without creating panic in the nation at large. Of course, this really wasn't a Dutch solution at all. It all came from Jewish influence, for they were the financiers who originally introduced it to Holland. During this same time, the English Navy doubled in size and made progress in becoming the world's best. In 1702, Anne became England's queen, and in that same year, France and England began the War of Spanish Succession. It was during this time, 1704, that a man by the name of John Churchill, a name that would eventually his progenitors would ring out throughout England's history. John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough, defeated the French at the Battle of Blenheim and saved Austria from invasion. In 1706, Marlborough again defeated the French at the Battle of Ramillies and expelled in the process the French from the Netherlands. And lastly, in 1709, Marlborough routed the French at the Battle of Malplaquet. This, plus the victories by the Navy at Le Havre and the successful blocking of the French coast from the Bay of Biscay to the Mediterranean Sea, resulted in the Treaty of Utrecht. With the ending of these wars in 1713, Queen Anne's representatives were able to obtain from France the following important necessary events to help the English move on. And that was, one, demolishing the fortifications at Dunkirk and the ceding of various territories in North America and the West Indies, to wit, Hudson Bay, Newfoundland, and Nova Scotia. England also received from Spain both Gibraltar and Majorca. To our study, this latter succession is most important. With the rock, known as Gibraltar, England would control the entrance and exit to the Mediterranean Sea. With Majorca, a northeastern island of the Balearic island chain, England now had another large deep-water port for its navy, and one which could block the French naval ports of Marseilles and Toulon. With the channel and the Straits of Dover and the northern entrance to the North Sea now under British command, England controlled the entrance and exit to one of the most used waterways for commerce in the world. Similarly, by controlling the entrance to the Mediterranean Sea, no one came in or out except by their benevolence. Slowly, ever so slowly, England was coming to hold all the important roadblocks to the seaways of the world. More important to this five-day study, England now was moving closer to the land of promise, even as Turkey and France were growing weaker. By the end of the War of Austrian Succession, 1740 through 48, and the 7 Years' War, 1756 to 63, both India and Canada had become part of the English domain. Soon naval ports would be set up in the Falkland Islands on one side of South America and Valparaiso near the entrance of the exit of the Cape of Horn. And also on the other side of the world, at Cape Town, near the entrance and exit of the Cape of Good Hope. By controlling these waterways to the Pacific and Indian Oceans, England found themselves holding all the major corners of the earth and the seaways that connected. How very much was this in the spirit of their ancient mariner friend, Tarshish. With a quick review of these wars in Europe, we now turn another page in New Tarshish history. We open the chapter to the early mid-18th century. It was a time when England entered the Industrial Revolution. It was the first time to do so, and it occurred because of a rocky substance that they found beneath the earth that caused a great deal of heat. What am I talking about?
Coal.
Very good. With deforestation, shortage of charcoal for smelting, and a growing demand for iron, major changes were demanded in the iron industries in England. The substance called coal was used for the first time instead of charcoal. Its power to ignite into a high heat-producing fuel became the heart and soul of Alan Darby's processes for creating iron. Additionally, with coal mines becoming deeper and deeper, more effective pumps were needed. This prompted the invention of the steam engine, Thomas Newcomb, and later James Watt's. These new machines made mass production possible for the first time. Winston Churchill, again in his book, The Age of Revolution, wrote these words, "In the last 40 years of the 18th century, exports and imports more than doubled in value and the population increased by over 2 million. England was silently undergoing a revolution in industry and agriculture. Steam engines provided a new source of power in factories and foundries, which rapidly multiplied. A network of canals was constructed which carried coal cheaply to new centers of industry. New methods of smelting brought a tenfold increase in the output of iron. New roads with hard and durable surfaces reached out over the country and bound it more closely together. An ever-expanding and assertive industrial community was coming into being. The rapid growth of an urban working class, the gradual extinction of small freeholders by enclosure, and improved farming methods, resulted in the sudden development of the manufacturers and the appearance of a prosperous middle class. All of this changed England from landowners to a viable working nation of industrialists." Brothers and sisters, in clothing alone, England was moving past wool. Suddenly, cotton was king. The Englishman John Kay introduced the flying shuttle. In 1733, this device could cut cotton twice as fast as before. Another problem rose when yarn was not being fed fast enough to the weaver. But in 1769, two new inventions solved that problem: the spinning jenny and the water-powered frame. Later, Edmund Cartwright in 1800 invented the power loom, which combined those two machines' characteristic into one. And lastly, with the use of coal and coke, a cheap way of smelting iron created a byproduct of gas. This gas was captured and provided a means for lighting streets and warming homes. Cheap power expanded the textile industries and created the railway networks. Most importantly, a preeminent naval presence in the area, what we know as the North Sea, kept England safe from all her enemies. The waters around her created a buffer, and that buffer kept her, unlike France, unlike the Germans or Hollands, in a much safer condition than she could ever be before. Along with these developments in commerce and trade came changes in the Navy. It started with one man, a man by the name of Samuel Pepys. As clerk of the Acts of the King's Ships, his responsibility was build ships, maintain dockyards, and feed and clothe their crews, very much as Hawkins had done 100 years before. This was a very highly responsible job, and it had a great many people employed, from contractors to full-timers. Indeed, by the mid-17th century, England's Royal Navy was the chief employer in this seafaring nation. Samuel Pepys saw his responsibility to make sure this vast complex operated as efficiently as possible. And so, from Portsmouth to Weymouth and from Deptford to Chatham, he haunted those dry docks and warehouses like a vile burglar hastening to its prey. Often, he would show up unannounced to observe if people were on duty or sober. More than once, he caught unscrupulous lumber agents selling the Navy wood with dry rot in it, or cheating on the linear board feet they claimed to have shipped. He found food providers cutting corners and selling cheap beer or grog that would quickly spoil. Soon his anger became legendary. Men would rather be kicked by the King of England than face the fierce wrath of Samuel Pepys. By spending wisely and working long hours into the night, he cleaned up much of the duplicity and outright fraud that had beguiled the Navy from time immemorial. In his pursuit of perfection, he was unstoppable, and he made people claim ownership for their end of the work. Moreover, he was the first to discontinue the practice of appointments by patronage, and the first to bring young teenage boys who showed promise into the Navy to learn the art of seamanship. Ability, not social rank, was what he aimed for. As far as Pepys was concerned, placing a frigate or a ship of the line in the hands of an untrained captain or lieutenant meant you were gambling with the lives of everyone on board. And if you expand that out, then once you lose your Navy, you lose that buffer that takes place between England and Europe. This man's energy and honesty eventually won many over. And though his first job was of patronage, his eventual promotion to Secretary to the Admiral was by deeds. During his time as head of the Navy dockyards, England gained the Barbados, Jamaica, and a good chunk of the North American seaboard. Indeed, Samuel Pepys would live to see the day when the Dutch hold on New Amsterdam would be lost and the English city of New York arise in its place. Moreover, it was during that same time that various companies would aid in establishing coastal colonies of New England, Virginia, North and South Carolina, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. Looking back in time overall, this man's accomplishments, his greatest achievement, perhaps, was to appoint a Captain Grenville Collins to survey the British coast and harbors in order to create an atlas of unsurpassed accuracy of the English coastline. He still uses it. By carrying out this challenge successfully, Pepys showed England what was possible in mapping out not just a country, but the world. And later on, you'll see how a man by the name of James Cook went as far, far to the west as possible, to places like Australia, and mapped out that area of the world. Furthermore, his spirit was captured in other areas of English success. The creation of a royal society in 1675 offered rewards for the innovations improving navigation at sea. It was a great impetus. With the backing of this royal society, numerous maritime discoveries occurred to help the English to become the great discoverers and seafarers of the 17th and 18th centuries. John Harrison, not a relative, built the first quality time piece, or chronometer, which aided seamen to figure out exactly where they were east and west of the prime meridian. They didn't have a good device for that before. If you couple that with John Hadley's famous sextant, an instrument which measured the height and angle of celestial bodies in relation to the earth, then captains finally had the two tools required to figure out latitude and longitude accurately. These inventions were English in origin, but soon would aid in helping to discover and map much of the world's ocean surface. In summary, England at last realized that naval-built ships have a purpose in war as well as in peace. Therefore, it was important to man and maintain a full-time navy. Second, to get good officers, England learned to start them young and send them to sea to learn the ways of command. Third, England continued to improve on sea tactics. The pioneering of the use of a system of coded signal flags was a major step forward in getting English squadrons to act as a team, not as standalones. Fourth, England developed their own maps for both the Navy and for their merchant fleet use. And lastly, England developed over time good administrators for the Navy to ensure that all her ships were properly maintained and provided for in the way of good food. Samuel Pepys started the English down the right road in his endeavor, but English captains like James Cook would take it to a higher level and actually find a cure for scurvy with the addition of concentrated carrot juice, lemons, and limes. In England, survival depended upon a sailor's action in battle, then they needed good quality food and higher quality beer that could stand the long voyages. Now, I mention all these details for a reason. And the reason has to do with the fact that it was commonly thought in those times that if a country was going to be a great nation, not just a nation, but a world leader, they must first occupy large amounts of real estate. And certainly there was a lot of land grabbing occurring throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. Still, it was only just coming into the consciousness of Englishmen that battles would be fought and at times lost. But the nation which had good financing, a good source of raw materials, food, clothing, health care, and a well-maintained navy to block your enemy's ports would eventually win any conflict. The first recorded evidence of this foresight for England came in the words of one John Evelyn, in the year 1674. He said, To pretend to universal monarchy without fleets of ships was long since looked upon as a politic chimera. Listen, whoever commands the ocean commands the trade of the world, and whoever commands the trade of the world commands the riches of the world, and whoever is master of that commands the world itself. What you just heard was the same philosophy rediscovered in the late 19th century, known as the Alfred Thayer Mahan theory of world domination. Still, as far-sighted as this vision was, it was nothing more than what the ancient mariner Tyre and Tarshish had already understood and acted upon several millennia before. Land be damned! It was trade across the waterways and sea lanes of the earth that made for real wealth. If you combine that with a quality merchant marine, a powerful navy, and throw in a moral people with a higher sense of purpose, you had what makes for the richest, most powerful nation on the earth. Indeed, it was going to take that and more if they were going to help make it possible for God's people to return. See you tomorrow.